You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and on this week's show, continuing this month's series of shows on horror and dark fantasy comics, I'm talking to Roger Gibson and Vince Danks, creators of the Fortean murder mystery comic Harker and the forthcoming Gravestown. I'm also talking to Alex DeCampi, filmmaker and writer of the e-comic Valentine. Later in the show, I'm discussing with Roger and Vince the importance of a good location in comics, whether it's the real-world locations of Harker or the fictional haunted Everytown of their new project. But first, I'm talking to Alex about the reasons that she chose Russia in 1812 as the initial setting of Valentine, and we're also thinking about a different kind of location, which is to say the place where readers consume their comics, so we're looking at the various formats you can download the periodical in. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner. FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
There's a graphic novel edition coming out of the first 8 chapters of Valentine. It's a comic that was first serialised on the web, but now that it is available in this larger chunk, do you find that more rewarding as a product, or did you like the serialised nature as it came out over the last year?
They're different books, really. I mean, they're different experiences. So, I've done tons of graphic novels. They're fun, but, you know, you work a long time to put them out, and then they're out, and people read them, and then that's it. The nice thing about serialised fiction is its regular nature. I mean, you're providing a short, brief hit of something very exciting to people that they can read during convenient parts of their day, on the tube, while commuting, while waiting in their office for something else to happen. You know, and that's in some ways a very satisfying way to write. It's been a historically successful form of fiction for a very long time, and there's reasons for that.
Mm. I mean, obviously, the serialized version has cliffhangers at the end of each chapter, as does the graphic novel. So when you started thinking about Valentine as a whole, was it easy to break it down into parts where you think this is the end of a chapter and then this is the end of a book?
Well, the nice thing about Valentine is it was a story I'd completely written in advance and hadn't really found a home for. I'd never really marketed it to anyone. I'd just written it because I was enjoying it, and it was a good way to press me from writing something considerably more difficult. The nice thing about doing it as a serialized fiction for mobile phones and small devices is, unlike a paper comic, if you serialize it in paper form, the paper issues have to be, are generally 22 to 24 pages of story.
Mm.
The phone versions can be any length, so I wasn't forced to unnaturally compress or expand story moments to fit an arbitrary printer's specification.
Yeah.
So the chapters vary in length from about 50 screens to about 85, I think is the longest. I went from my original story and just found appropriate places that would be an exciting place to leave the story. I always knew exactly where we'd end with the first 8 chapters. Other than that, you know, I always knew that Valentine would be good as a serialized story because it did have so many twists and turns, and it did have so many cliffhangers built into it.
As it's a comic that's been serialized in a different selection of ways, that there's an iPhone version, an iPad version, a Kindle version, did you find it a challenge trying to think of the different ways that people would consume it? Because obviously, reading it panel by panel is a different experience to reading it page by page.
Well, we started off with the phone version, and my first concern was to optimize it for reading on small devices, rather than just taking a paper. Pretty much every other phone comic right now is something as a paper comic, which has been cut up into individual panels which may or may not fit the entire screen. The lettering might be too big or too small, and the art might pixelate if you make the letters large enough to actually be legible, and so forth. You know, we said, okay, we're gonna use all the real estate on that phone, we can. A number of techniques to create a visual storytelling flow to it. And then the book version, we always kind of said, oh, well, of course there'll be a graphic novel version, because I have loads of friends, you know, myself included, who don't have smartphones or iPads. You know, I'm a writer, I'm really broke, I don't have an iPad. Apple products are too expensive for me. A year down the road, and now we came to the end of that road with episode 8. But yeah, we really have to do that book version now, don't we? So I sat about 2 weeks before New York Comic Con in front of a hot copy of Photoshop to relay the book out in digest form. And, you know, I'll be honest, I was very concerned that it would have, you know, that it would be exciting and readable and not just feel like some rather stale grid format. And so we managed to do it. It still has a wonderful sense of pacing in the book version as well as the phone version. The book version also, the more I work with some of the e-reading formats like Kindle, like iBooks, like EPUB, which is the main format for everything, you know, the more I realize that the short serialized comic format doesn't work very well in EPUB. Graphic novels work really well if they're small and they digest format, but something that's just a single episode, people were like, oh, that feels awfully short, because they're used to reading novels on the Kindle. That's where you go for a novel. You go to your phone or your computer or something in color for something shorter, like a YouTube video or an episode of a comic or something like that. So, you know, the black and white e-readers and anything where you would naturally read a novel, people wanted to read a much longer work all in one. And so, print, you know, the actual print version printed actually on dead trees with ink and stuff is still in the works. We're now available on Kobo, which is one of the big e-reader stores, and we're going to soon be available on iBooks as well for the 236-page graphic novel version.
I was wondering if your experiences as a short filmmaker and writing comics kind of feed into each other, because what you're saying about consuming shorter chapters on a mobile phone is also the way that some people consume YouTube videos. And then at the same time, thinking of formatting the comic from something you consume as panels and something you read as pages also makes me think of choosing different ways of framing shots as well, going from, say, a close-up to a larger widescreen image.
Yeah, the filmmaking very much feeds into it. I mean, I'm a visual storyteller. My literary agent is always saying, you know, write a novel, write a prose novel. I can do all sorts of things with that. Okay, then, well, even I don't have pictures in it. I don't know what to do if there aren't any pictures. I have to write internal monologue. I don't like doing that. It's boring. So, you know, I tell stories with pictures. I try to generally use as few words as possible. And so my comic book storytelling has always been quite cinematic, just because that's how I think of stories. Moving to the phone version of Valentine, that really started to mine some of the Cinematography 101 toolbook. It's not a motion comic. It's not one of these Brundle fly things that add in cheap bits of motion to it. A not very good comic to make it some strange, awful hybrid that doesn't really work. But what we did do is, because we can't have the left to right and down reading experience of a Western comic, the phone comic is essentially read like you're looking at a little landscape box and you're essentially tunneling into that box. We used more filmmaking techniques in terms of picking what each screen would show and how the screens relate to each other. Then we might otherwise do in a comic, where we can use panel size and page design and number of panels on the page to create certain effects. I enjoy the intellectual challenge of telling a story in a format in the way that is most appropriate for that format. And taking something that would work in another format and thinking, okay, well, this wouldn't work on a phone. How do I express the same feeling? How do I slow the reader down? How do I speed the reader up? How do I surprise them? You know, how do I make them feel that an area is very big or very small?
Well, you know, like you said, you don't have movement, but you do have fades in and out, where you take a frame and then add additional elements. For example, you have early on in the comic, there's a picture of the snowy wastes of Russia. Then you add a raven, and then you add a text box. And I thought that was a really interesting way of creating a panel as it sort of is created by the artist and the letterer in terms of making the comic to start off with.
What we were doing there was, as I said before, we were trying to slow the reader down. The story opens during Napoleon's retreat from Russia in 1812, which was a military and humanitarian disaster of truly epic proportions. But it's not one we'd expect anyone to really know about unless they're just water over military history. And so we wanted to cause people to read it more slowly and not zip through it. So, you know, you're presented with this picture of the army retreating in the snow, and you tap, and the date comes up, and you tap, and the captions come up. So you've had three taps to actually get everything that would normally just be presented immediately to you. You tap again, you know, the image scrolls to the right, and in fact, it's a five-panel panorama of the snowy wasteland and the army retreating. So, you know, I'm telling you in a storytelling manner a number of things with that opening sequence. One, you're in a very large space. You know, you're in the middle of nowhere. Two, a lot of people are dying. And three, things are moving quite slowly, and you need to appreciate that all these people are dying, that there's a lot of detail in the panel, and here you go. And then, you know, the story speeds up after that and becomes quite twisty and danger rears its head quite quickly. But, you know, I've hopefully gotten people into the mood of that time and that situation and that scene. We also use color a lot to do that. I've worked with a wonderful artist and a colorist, and we, you know, we almost color code scenes. There's a lot more variation in color saturation than you would between scenes than you would normally see in a comic.
Like you said, the color is very important. I mean, I really like the way that you have a limited color palette in the various locations, and then it goes into technicolor when you go into the realms of magic. But at the same time, one of the ways that I consumed Valentine, I guess, was your least favourite, by reading it on a Kindle. But I thought that the tonality of the comic actually still translated very well to grayscale.
That's good to know, because, you know, we've had a lot of problems with Amazon as a seller. You know, we do really well on the Kindle. The funny thing is, like, we're one of the best-selling comics, even on the episode-by-episode basis, and even with what I was saying about people not liking short episodes as much as they like longer work. We like the best-selling comic on the Kindle for like 4 months running. Yeah, the grayscale kills me. That's one of the reasons we haven't moved that aggressively into the other e-readers, because it's partially just a sort of creator snobism, but working so hard to get the colors right and then bashing them down into grayscale. It's wonderful to hear that it still works, but it breaks my heart to actually have to break them down into grayscale. This is why we're mainly going for iBooks for the electronic graphic novel version, because at least there's a fighting chance of people seeing it in color. And the other tablets, of course, that are coming out, most of which are running the Silver Reader. The whole comics on e-reader thing is something that's really yet to coalesce. I mean, you know, they're wonderful programs if you're a comic fan for reading comics on your phone or your computer or your iPad or whatever color tablet you have, you know. Robot Comics, Comixology, Bave Comics in France, which is a great way to get wonderful French fandom in there very inexpensively, often in English as well. The opportunities there are legion, and we've grabbed onto as many of them as possible. But I think for a lot of comics people who also read novels, which is most of them, the Holy Grail is getting graphic novels side by side with electronic editions of prose novels. And that very, very few people are doing that, and there's very little way for independent publishers to actually get on e-readers in a way which is a satisfying experience to the reader and to the publisher. Tablets will change all that because they're in lovely color, and comics should generally be in color.
Yeah, definitely. The initial setting of the comic, of the French invasion of Russia in 1812, where did the idea to start off there came about?
It started off, I don't know what I've been reading. I've been reading something about Napoleon, and you know, I know exactly what it was. The chap named Menard, who was a French cartographer and statistician, but it's an awesome book. It really is. I create stories with pictures. Just create stories about numbers with pictures. So I'm naturally interested in that. And Menard's map is one of the greatest things ever made, and I mean that. It should be in that the top 100 objects thing, but it won't be. And the map shows Napoleon's army going into Russia as this really fat line, and going out of Russia as, half a million people going in, coming out of Russia as less than 50,000 people, and it's graphed against temperature. It's just a piece of general gradient. And I looked at this, and I became fascinated by why, one of the greatest military commanders of his age was so colossally stupid and managed to wipe out his entire army, and in fact, pretty much his empire, with this one insane attempt to start a land war in Russia. And so I somewhat became obsessed with the 1812 war based on that, read a few books on it. And then, just the image of white snow, blue bodies, and red blood, there's something very graphical about it. So I thought, I'm going to start the story off during this time because it's such a visually promising and evocative situation for a comic. And it didn't feel like it had been used very much.
And then at the same time, the themes of magic and heroism that you introduce into the plot, the idea of a hero who wields a magical sword, his rescue by an underwater lady, the various portals that take place in stone circles, you're tapping into Arthurian legend there. So the mixture of a sort of a European setting and then sort of very British storytelling seems quite an interesting mix and a way of maybe taking local tales onto a larger scenario.
Well, one of the conceits of the book is that all the fairy tales are true to some extent. And so I used, ones that I was fairly familiar with, the Arthurian tales, some of the things coming out of the Welsh and Celtic mythology, trying not to hug too closely to it. I mean, it's not necessarily a wholly British basis for some of the research. One of the characters, Roland, who plays this one three times, is a character out of French myth and legend. The wonderful thing about working in, though I call the book a supernatural thriller, a lot of it is takes from the fantasy toolbox. And the wonderful thing about the fantasy toolbox, especially for me, is as a very avid reader of everything from, very traditional original text to crappy fantasy books you can buy at the airport with tiny metallic cover text. It's unlimited what you can do with all these wonderful tools that we've had for the stories for so long. And magic sword, not really something new, but you just throw it in there in a new way. Lady of the Lake, not very new, been around for a while, throwing it in a new way. And then, as Valentine eventually learns more about the characters of folklore and magic, and in fact, those to where they come from, you have a really fun bait and switch there where we started off in very trad fantasy land. And then very quickly, we kind of sat around and said, if you could make anything happen, what would your world look like? It wouldn't be like green rolling hills and castles. And it might be for about 5 minutes, and then you get bored of that and turn it into checkerboard. Would you take what people's expectations are of a very well-loved genre, and while being respectful of them, we then turn them on their head?
But also what I was getting at, the way that you're sort of fusing tales from various different cultures is also explicit in the creatures themselves, like the Tenebrae are mixtures of all sorts of mythological creatures mixed together. And I really like the way that that actually seems to tap more into subconscious fears than, sort of more physical readings of myths and legends.
Yeah, I'm big on, subconscious fear and horror is something that shows up a lot in my work, and if you define things too narrowly, they become less scary. Readers are always better at imagining scary things themselves. So if you describe it too much or say it's exactly this or limit it, that's why a lot of the current Renaissance of books on vampires and werewolves is interesting because they're really not very scary.
Is there a particular genre that you like writing about most? Because it's interesting the way that you've very much segued in your comic book work from one type of storytelling to another, that Valentine mixes all sorts of different genres, from historical to fantasy to horror. Then something like Smoke mixes political thrillers and satire and science fiction. And then even your children's book, Agent Boo, mixes sort of superhero tropes with children's fantasy. So the fluidity of genre seems to be something that interests you.
I never think about the genre when I set out to write the story in some ways. I love genre. I've read genre fiction my entire life. I always start off with a character in a situation, and it becomes a thriller somehow. Everything I write is fundamentally always a thriller. I love the more more work I do, I find myself always moving towards, you know, the sort of suspense thriller, regular cliffhanger type of writing. But within that, I'm always trying to write about real people and real reactions. See this in a lot of big action films and thriller films and Hollywood stuff like that. To make the people who are going through the situation not feel very realistic. And so I like to kind of imagine what a normal human being, even one who's, for instance, a trained soldier or a reporter or something like that, so what they would do in a given situation. And part of this, I'm influenced a lot by a lot of Korean and Japanese action and thriller films, where there's always this moment of like human absurdity in the middle of everything. You know, it's this very po-faced action scene will happen, and then someone will do something stupid or start talking about something trivial or commit suicide with a box cutter and completely fail and just look really pathetic doing it. You know, you kind of always have to bring the humanity into the story on a regular basis, and that's kind of what I do. And sometimes it's in fantasy. I was really excited to write Valentine because, you know, I think you can tell it's a fantasy toolbox. It's something I really love and have a lot of affection for. I love thinking up unusual action scenes, which is fed into my work in Smoke and my work in Valentine as well. So part of it is just, you know, I find something I love and I write about it. And it comes out in a certain way because I tend to write in a certain kind of absurdist thriller way.
Do you find that moving between back and forth between projects and back and forth between media helps keep the work fresh? Because obviously you've been writing comics at the same time as you've been making music videos. And now in between the end of Valentine Book 1 and Valentine Book 2, it's just been announced that you're returning to Smoke with a new series in the new year.
Fiction is kind of a chronic pain. Music videos and commercials and short films are kind of an acute pain. You know, a music video will be pitched, shot, and released within a month. You know, suddenly there's this panic, you get picked up for something, there's a panic, you do it, it's out, gone, and that wipes out your month. Stories for me are something that I circle back on and circle back on and circle back on. I've been writing Valentine for 5 years, off and on, not all the time, you know. Go through a couple of months of working on it, stick it into work, bring it back out again, and think, God, I really don't like that bit. That bit's really crap. No, get rid of it and rewrite that bit, etc. There's almost this constant stream of stories that I'm working on in the back of my head. You know, Smoke, second book of Smoke is one of them. There's something else called Margaret the Damned, which is kind of existential suburban horror starting after Smoke. Also, any writer will tell you, I'm sure you can get collaboration on this, but when you're working on a long story, I tend to write the entire script before starting to parcel it out to people. Don't necessarily outline it, but I write it. You know, it's all done. I know where it's going to end. I know how long it's going to be. When you're in the middle of a story like that, they tend to get difficult. You know, they kind of rebel on you a bit. It's really like pushing rocks uphill. And then some new idea will spark at the corner of your mind. Take a couple of days off and work on that other idea. It's really easy. It's kind of like a new relationship, you know. You don't know the most of their underwear is gray and stuff, and they snore and stuff like that. They're just kind of new and sparkly and wonderful. So you go off and you flirt with a new idea, and you write a couple chapters of that. And then you trudge back to your old idea and keep chipping away at that. Yeah. So it's a very common thing for writers to have a couple of things on the go. Because if you are really just working on one, it can very much do your head in. And it helps to have them be in very different genres or be very different stories. As a writer, you're always terrified that all your characters will sound the same. So if you're moving through something where this story, you know, Valentine, where people speak in a very specific way, and the characters are, you know, kind of very well known to me at this point, although there's a couple of new ones entering the story in book two, there's a significant step away from how the story is written and how the people express themselves and what's going on and the pacing, and that's refreshing. And then while you're working on the other story, like the problem in story number one tends to unknot itself in the back of your mind.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You can find Valentine in Amazon's Kindle store, as an iPhone and iPad download, on your computer and on your Android phone in up to 14 languages by visiting www.valentinethecomic.com. Next, here's my interview with Roger Gibson and Vince Danks about their comics Harker and Gravestown. I'm at the British International Comic Show with Vince Danks and Roger Gibson, creator of Harker. You just said to me that you've put Harker on hold momentarily while you concentrate on a new horror series, Gravestown. I was wondering if you could just elaborate a little on the history of the two comics. Harker is kind of a love letter to various British detective shows and genres and writers from over the years.
Yeah, that because that's something that both Roger and I really enjoy. It seemed to make sense to do a comic based on that, and it's also something that obviously everybody watches TV, what likes detective stories.
Yeah.
But there's not much of that in comics, so we thought that would be interesting to do, and it has been received really well, very well received critically. It sold well, and now, as you say, we've got the we're negotiating a publishing deal, so that's temporarily on hold while that gets sorted out. Meanwhile, we thought, right, well, rather than sitting around twiddling our thumbs, let's do something completely different. And Gravestown is an idea that Roger had a long time ago, and it seemed like an obvious thing to pick up on and do.
Mm. I mean, you've got an old Gravestown comic for sale as well from 1997. What's the relationship between the new version and the old version? Is it a remake, a remix, or completely just taking the original setting and changing it for a new publication?
Largely what you said latterly, it's we're doing a complete reboot of it, so the core content of the place where it takes place is the same, but we have new characters, new information, a whole new storyline, and of course we now have Vince drawing it, and he's a far better artist than I was 13 years ago. But it's, at its core, it's going to be sort of a gothic horror series where we're promoting it as the most terrifying comic you'll ever read.
That's quite a challenge.
Very terrifying. Because I've never read a comic that's actually scared me. Okay. So we're going to try to actually scare people with this one. But in the same way as we do with Harker, where we're going to take generic horror stuff in the same way we did generic detective stuff and that, and mixing with some wry humour as well to try and make it sort of funny and a little bit scary as well, trying to make it a pleasure to read. And we started it literally only just on Wednesday, but we're working on it monthly as we did with Harker, so it'll start pouring out from us over the next 3-4 months.
I mean, you've got some promotional art for it here, but at the risk of not revealing too many spoilers, could you go into more detail about what the series is going to involve?
Certainly, yeah. It's essentially about a couple of people, Genevieve and Cornelius, who find themselves in a Narnia-like world. They step through a door, find themselves trapped in there. And it's a large city full of ghosts, ghouls, vampires, everything you can imagine from the horror scenario, and they have to survive in this place. The storyline essentially was turned into a large vampire mythology series for the first 6 issues, which should be hopefully quite exciting.
Yeah, that's right. But there's also a plan, if the series is ongoing, to introduce, so it won't just be horror elements, there'll be kind of supernatural elements, some Fortiana, all sorts of stuff. I mean, basically anything that's a bit weird, or even very weird, it'll be in there. And obviously we'll be exploring the kind of people that have to deal with that environment, people who already live there, people who have been trapped previously in there, how do they cope? So there's quite a lot of interesting avenues to explore, not just the horror aspect, but obviously it will be scary as well. Sorry, go on.
What locations have you been looking at in terms of finding an identity for Gravestown as a place? Because when I think of Harker, it has always had very strong locations, whether it's been the various British museums that you explore in one of the series, whether it's the town of Whitby that you explore in another. So where have you gone to, either metaphorically or literally, for Gravestown?
It's going to be a mix, a melange of different places. But, I mean, we live in York, and York has a wide range of locations, so we'll be basing it on a sort of alternate version of York, but then mixing in places from Venice, from London, from anywhere and everywhere, really.
Well, I mean, obviously the concept is Roger's, but the way I approached it from the point of view of doing the artwork is I kind of imagined that Gravestown was actually an entity, a living entity, and it had a fascination for weird stuff, weird buildings. So it would kind of like go somewhere, and if as like a tourist you go somewhere and you think, oh, that building's really nice, I'll take a photograph of it, Gravestown would pinch the building and recreate it and just plonk it in the town. So it's a complete mixture of of all sorts of things, but it will always look weird and odd, and obviously because it's all mixed up, it will even look even more weird. But it's largely Gothic and medieval. When I've been hunting around for reference, a lot of it is kind of European medieval, and the big structures are Gothic. So that's largely what it's based on. But there'll be all sorts of stuff, and there'll be pyramids, obelisks, all sorts of stuff.
Cool. I mean, are both of you York born and bred? Because it strikes me as a city that has a very rich and a very rich history that also has a flavour of the occult. I mean, I personally have been on a ghost walk around York, and it's a prime location for that. Having grown up there, do you think that led you to creating the subject matter in your comics right from the start?
I think you become infused with it. I think if you live somewhere that's got a lot of old medieval buildings, you start to absorb it, certainly as a writer I do. I've always been fascinated by old, strange, weird architecture, but what I always want to do is explore them. If I see a building that looks a little odd from outside, or a door that looks a little strange or peculiar, I want to go through it, I want to see what's in there. That's pretty much what we're doing in Greystone. We're taking you in there, but then not letting you back out again. But certainly, yes, I mean, York is superb for that sort of thing.
That's right. But in answer to your question, actually, neither of us were born and bred York. Okay. Roger's from Scarborough, and I'm actually I was born in Kenya, but I'm largely from down south. But we've both lived in York for a long time. So as Roger says, you kind of get infused with it, and you sort of think medieval Gothic because that's what York is, and it's a beautiful city, but it's a fascinating environment, and it's also spooky.
Well, it's interesting that you've spoken about creating Gravestown from taking one building here, one obelisk there, because that idea of making a sort of a portmanteau location in some ways can often be more evocative than going to a real location.
That's right.
I mean, I don't know if you've seen, there's a Michael Winterbottom film called Code 46, which is set in Shanghai in 20, 30 or 40 or whatever, but what he did was create an architectural collage by shooting bits in London, bits in the real Shanghai and so on, create a city that kind of represents all futuristic cities.
Yes, that's right, and obviously Gravestown will, because it's completely made up, we can actually do what we like, but we would like to people to feel as though they are getting to know it to some extent, but they never really know it. And part of the theory behind it is it does actually change a bit itself. I mean, it will pop up new buildings because it feels like it, or it'll shift things around. But I'd like people to start becoming familiar with it, so that it does have an entity, like you get used to the place where you live. The characters are going to have to get used to living there, and it would be nice if the reader got at least a bit familiar with it.
I mean, the core of the story essentially is, if you find yourself trapped in a huge haunted house which changes around you constantly, how would you cope? How would you live? How would you intermingle into it? And what dangers would surround you while you're doing it? So.
You spoke about the first arc being about vampires. Obviously, vampires are incredibly popular at the moment, what with the likes of True Blood on TV and the Twilight novels being adapted for film. Do you worry that it's a slightly saturated market?
Yes.
And in order to find new ways of telling the vampire myth, you have to be both original and familiar in the storytelling?
I agree, definitely, yeah. There's an awful lot of vampire things out at the moment. There's also an awful lot of detective things out at the moment. The thing that we tried to do with Harker was say, let's pile all this stuff together and make something new and humorous out of it. We're going to try and do the same in Gravestown, where we'll take the initial myths, core of vampire mysteries and ghosts and things, but try and give it a humorous twist, try and get something new and amusing from it, and also a little bit scary. So yes, it's overused, and everybody knows the vampire mythology, and there's an awful lot of it about, so we're going to try and give it a humorous twist.
Also, we'll probably tend to be a bit more traditional in our approach to vampires. I mean, most vampire stuff that's around at the moment is obviously aimed at quite a young audience, so it tends to all be teenagers and are largely soap opera based, whereas ours is more kind of Gothic horror. It's going to be more like a Hammer House of Horror than True Blood. So it'll be, I mean, obviously there'll be vampires, but obviously there'll also be other characters in there as well. Even during the vampire story, we won't exclude the other characters or the other things that are going on, and I think that will make it original.
I mean, maybe a good way to look at it would be, you used the word portmanteau earlier, and some of my favourite old films are the old Hammer portmanteau films from the 1970s. Gravestown is essentially a huge portmanteau film which just keeps on going. So that's what we're trying to get.
Because this is following Harker, and you set issues of Harker in places which have kind of a 14, to use your word, setting, did you find it difficult to actually leave some of the horror out of Harker that actually you could have inserted more of? And this is now, in a way, scratching that itch.
Sort of. I mean, when we initially started the first issue of Harker, the first one, even in the first few pages, is quite graphic, and there's even a couple of naughty swear words. We quickly realised we didn't want to do that. We wanted to make it very mainstream, very sort of ITV Morse sort of thing. And we found that we'd rather go for a more mainstream and softer approach. I've not really got any interest in horror as a genre. I like everybody else, I like the occasional horror film, I like ghost stories. But I'm more interested in people's reaction to those sort of stories and trying to find a different angle into it. So no, it's not a question of scratching an itch to try and do some things we weren't able to in Harker. It's more a question of it interests me. I think there's humour to be had in there. And I also think it's just the sort of venue that Vince would love to draw.
Well, yeah, because obviously one of the things we found doing Harker, a lot of the feedback was from where the art point of view was concerned, people loved all the buildings and the architecture and liked the fact that there was a sense of place with it. And where the writing was concerned, they loved the humour and they loved the character interaction. So I was like, well, with Gravestown, we can exploit both those strengths that we have as a creative team. But also, I like fantasy, I like horror as well. And I think that it just gives us a lot more scope to play and have fun with it.
What is your process as a creative team? Is it that you write a full script and you draw it, or is it more collaborative in the sort of kind of like the old Marvel way that you'd have a plot and then the art and then the script and so on?
We work Marvel style. It's sort of quite complex, but we go to the pub, we tend to plot it together, and then Vince goes away and draws it. When he's finished his artwork, I then script over the artwork. So it's sort of Marvel style, with a few sort of little twists here and there, but it's very collaborative. We work on it very, very strongly together. So Vince is in charge of the artwork, I'm in charge of the scripting, but there's a mix between the two. We collaborate very strongly together.
Yeah, and it's also a quicker way of working. I mean, bear in mind that Harker is a monthly comic. There's only two of us doing it, and Gravestown will be the same. If Rog had to sit down and write a full script, it might take him a month to do that, and we haven't got the time. Whereas if we go to the pub together and Rog tells me what he wants on each page, I can make notes, I can go away and storyboard it, and it's all done relatively quickly, and it seems to work. Whereas writing full scripts, I don't think would. I think we'd find that more difficult.
And I suppose having worked together for quite some time now, you can almost anticipate the way the other person will either write or draw, and so it becomes almost subconsciously collaborative.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
I can generally use shorthand and sort of explain to Vince quite easily the sort of thing I want. He'll do little thumbnail sketches while we're doing the plotting, so he'll know that I want a full page here, he'll know that I want two pages of this particular scene, and then I'll just leave him, so I know the sort of work he'll do, I can leave him to go off and do it right, and then scripting over the top of that is very, very easy. He generally has an idea of the sort of script that I'm going to be doing, so we've discussed the story, so it works well. I think more people should do it that way, because it's a quick and easy way to do it.
And the first issue of Gravestown comes out?
Well, we've literally just started it this week. By the time it gets through Diamond, we think it'll probably be about February or March time. More likely to be March by the time the first issue comes out.
And it's going to follow the same kind of pattern as Harker, that you're going to do a number of monthly comics and then collect them as a book later?
That's right.
Yes, we're initially doing six monthly issues. We'll then collect that. And then we may do six more of Harker, or we may do six more of Gravestown. It'll be one of the two, but certainly it'll be monthly and then collected.
And the model of doing a monthly comic first and then collecting it, presumably that's something that's worked for you rather than just doing one or the other.
Yeah, I mean, many people say that monthly comics are fading, and I think to an extent they are. We sell far more collections than monthly comics, but for us ourselves, we find it helps us keep to the deadline. If we're putting it out, we've got a deadline for each monthly comic. We know we have to have it finished by that point, and it pulls people in. People find an odd issue and say, "Oh, I quite like the look of this," and go for more. So.
Well, that's right. I mean obviously the comic actually serves as a promotion for the collected edition, but it also, you get feedback. You know, instead of spending 6 months producing a graphic novel without any idea of whether people are going to like it, you're putting out the comic. People are saying, "Oh, that's great. It's motivational." You get the thing finished, and then you bring out the collected edition. I think that's a good way of working. And as Roger says, it's a good discipline as well. Means you stick to the deadline.
And have you had any thoughts about digital distribution of the monthly comics, say doing an iPad version?
Yes, I mean, we have PDFs on the site of Harker, but we found that they don't really sell at the moment. I mean, I think that in the next 2-3 years, at the latest, I think there's going to be a lot more of that sort of thing, because it's already working with books, it's already worked with music, so surely the comics should be the next thing. It doesn't seem to have taken off yet, but I think as more and more people are buying Kindles, more and more people are getting used to that sort of thing, I think there'll be a lot more of that. So we will certainly be releasing our work in that format. But
yeah, well, it may be that the release of the iPad is what is needed to kickstart it. So I think, as Roger says, give it a couple of years, and there'll be a lot more of it going on. We won't think about it in the meantime, because we've got enough to think about. But yeah, we will have to think about it at some stage.
Cool. Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find more info about Roger and Vince's comics at www.arielpress.com. That's arielpress.com. And Harker volumes 1-3 are available now in all good comic book shops. You can find more info about the comics discussed in this episode on our blog, www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Since there were only 3 broadcast episodes of Panel Borders on air and online this month, fans of horror comics might like to know that I'll be discussing the serialized graphic novel The Walking Dead and its TV adaptation with artist Charlie Adlard at the London Print Studio in London's Little Venice on the 6th of November at 4:30 p.m. More info at www.comicafestival.com. That's comicafestival. And Panel Borders will be back at the same time next week, where we're starting a month of shows looking at atypical renderings of superheroes, starting with Yannick Paquette and Nicholas Scott's recent work for DC Comics. Thanks for listening.